Joining me now is Dr. Bob Pelz. He is the Peace Health Oregon's top infectious disease specialist and on the governor's COVID-19 task force. And Dr. Pelz, welcome. I wanted to start off with kind of getting going back and getting an overview of the coronavirus. I mean, we have learned, I think, so much since we first found out about this disease and this virus. Where are we at now with the virus? What do we know about it as of today?
Yeah, it's been dizzying and really unprecedented the pace of medical research that's been done on this one infection over the course of the last months. As you know, nobody on the planet had ever been exposed to this particular virus in the past, and it appears to be extraordinarily contagious. So brief exposures to people that aren't wearing masks can result in transmission. People don't get any symptoms at all from this. Younger people, 80-90%, may not have any symptoms at all, which is great for them, but it means that they can transmit the virus without knowing it, and they can bring it home to people that are vulnerable, like the elderly or people with other medical problems. So it's very common, very infectious, and for some people, very lethal.
So are we finding out that I heard one day someone was talking about the way the droplets spread can be more extreme than originally was first thought. Is that still the case, or that still the thought?
Yeah, that's still the subject of some controversy. It's like there's a spectrum of how this virus can be transmitted. For the most part, to be something that's transmitted with larger respiratory droplets that will drop out of the air over the span of a few feet. So the 6-foot distancing recommendation that is, everybody hears about, probably is a distance in which almost all of the respiratory virus droplets will drop to the ground and not be infectious. There are probably some circumstances, singing or loud speaking, where the may be aerosolized, or certain medical procedures where smaller respiratory droplets that can be infectious can travel long distances. That's how infections like chickenpox and measles are spread, and they can be contagious over much longer distances than COVID appears to be spread. So I think by and large, we're still pretty confident that this is transmitted by respiratory droplets, which are those larger particles, but sometimes it can be an aerosol transmission like tuberculosis or measles.
And even something like an uncovered sneeze can really send that out there, I would imagine.
Potentially, yeah. I mean, I think that for the most part, a sneeze or a cough is going to generate respiratory droplets that are the larger ones that can fall down. But it's, there's probably some increased risk with anything like that.
Well, I think
you kind of need to wear a mask, I think, is the important thing, both to protect you from other people and other people from you.
Well, you kind of gave us a kind of an overview of where we are now with this, but how is this different from something like SARS?
Yeah, as people have come to know, SARS is another coronavirus. There are multiple different coronaviruses that cause infections in people. About 15% of the common cold is caused by any one of four different strains of coronavirus. And then there's SARS, which was around in the early 2000s and killed about 10% of the people that got it. And we were able to eradicate that mostly because almost nobody that got that infection asymptomatic. So if they got infected, you knew it and you could isolate them and contain the infection. Not the case with the current COVID.
And that's the problem is, like you said, you got people walking around that could easily, without their knowledge, kind of transmit the disease.
Yeah.
So now, it was just in the news again a couple days ago, is the hydroxychloroquine, which the president and others have promoted at certain points. What do we know about this drug?
Yeah, this is something that stays in the headlines for reasons that I think are puzzling to people that are used to reading medical research. There are various ways that we figure out if a medication works. The step commonly is to see if it works in vitro, like in a petri dish, in the laboratory. And there was early optimism about hydroxychloroquine because it's already available. You could just prescribe it because it's out on the market already, and it seemed to work in the lab. So our hospital and many hospitals around the country used it early on. But there are legion examples of medications that are promising that end up not working when you actually test them where the rubber meets the road, which is when you give it to people to see if it works to prevent infections. And there have been numerous studies done repeatedly showing the same thing, which is that hydroxychloroquine does work to protect people from getting sick with the coronavirus, does not work to protect people once they are infected with coronavirus. It just doesn't work. Multiple studies published in the most prestigious medical journals have shown the same thing over and over again. It's just time to stop talking about that.
And again, we just kind of skip clinical trials for before some doctors were trying to prescribe it, right?
Yeah, because we were desperate.
Right.
We still, if there's something that's safe that might work, a lot of doctors will use it. But as a physician, I always try not to give people medications if they don't work, if they don't need them, or if it's avoidable. And hydroxychloroquine's very safe, but there are some toxicities. I had a patient I took care of recently who had to stop taking it because it caused problems with her eyes. She could have lost her vision. And there are people that really benefit from this medication, people with lupus and other conditions like that. So if people start using it inappropriately for COVID, then the people that really need it, where it really works, might not get access to it.
So, what is the latest update on a vaccine? I know I talked the other day, Dr. Foster. He said there's like 27 different drugs in clinical trials right now.
Stanford University has a website that curates kind of the trials that are being done on various treatments and vaccines, and they list 21 different vaccines under development. And there are various phases of vaccine development. Phase one is where the vaccine doesn't have any toxicities. Phase two, you look for some sort of a response, like an antibody response. And in phase three trials, you actually give the vaccine to people to see if it protects them from infection. And there are several vaccines, I believe five, that are in phase three clinical trials. About 100,000 people have received doses of one vaccine or another in the process of trying to develop these vaccines. And there are a couple of vaccines on the market that have already been shown to protect primates from COVID infection.
Now
Uh,
these.
so I think that there's reason to be optimistic. There's been a vaccine development for like this in human history.
Now, when you develop a vaccine for something like this, do you use known entities already or to coordinate with other things, or is this all start from scratch, kind of?
Sure, what you mean by that, like
Well, in other words, like for example, we found out that maybe some other vaccine worked for some, like we're talking about the other hydroxychloroquine, but we found out something that worked for a specific disease and it showed promise in another, but maybe not enough. Do they take something from that one vaccine to help develop a new vaccine, or
I
do
see
they
what you're
start?
saying. So the only one that I'm familiar with is there's this vaccine called BCG, which is used in some parts of the world to try to protect people against tuberculosis, and it boosts the immune system. There's a study being done in Australia whether this tuberculosis vaccine might provide some protection against COVID. All of the other vaccines that I have found are vaccines that are developed, for the first time, just specifically targeting this one by one method or another.
Now, in every time that the word vaccine comes up in a conversation, you have a percentage of group of people, and an organ seems to be filled with an inordinate amount of those folks that are against vaccines. How do we work with those people to convince them that, this might be the only way to eradicate this?
That's something that public health officials struggle with. We know that vaccines will protect people from infections that can be life-threatening to them or people in their community. And we know that the vaccines that are currently on the market are safe. I think people are afraid of what's new, and these vaccines are being marketed probably faster than any other vaccine. And I think people will be concerned that maybe there are shortcuts on safeties for the safety of the vaccine. If we're going to get our economy up and running, if we're going to get our children back to school again, we need to have a way to protect our population, and the vaccine probably is the only way that that's going to happen. In New York City, something like 10 to 20% of people probably got infected, but the price that we paid for that was that one out of every 500 New Yorkers died of COVID. And if they are right, then we need to have about 70% immunity against COVID-19 to have what they call herd immunity, where you can eventually shut down transmission of the infection. If that's to be achieved by letting people get infected, there are going to be an awful lot of deaths in this country that are potentially avoidable. We're either going to get to herd immunity, we do, it's either going to be by getting vaccines, which are probably going to be pretty safe, or by people get COVID, and we know that that's going to kill a bunch of people. Well, are going to have a choice to make about whether they're going to vaccine or not. And, you know, I tell you, I'm going to be in the front of the line to get a vaccine when they come out.
Well, and two, you know, the beginning of the vaccine wars, I'll call that for want of a better word, there were some questions about what might have been going into the vaccine. And a lot of that has been asked and answered, you know, changed in some cases. So just because it's a new vaccine doesn't mean it has some of the old stereotypes that go along with it, right?
Yeah, you know, some of the vaccines had microscopic amounts of mercury in them, and people were afraid that that might affect the nervous system of children with multiple various vaccines being given. More modern vaccines don't include that anymore, and I think a vaccine manufacturer would be foolish to bring a vaccine to market with mercury in it now, knowing how that's going to affect people to receive the vaccine. I don't expect that they're going to make those unforced errors in developing the next vaccine.
So you mentioned about 70% for herd immunity. What amount of effectiveness does that mean? The vaccine itself will also have to follow that 70%? I know that I think Dr. Foster was saying that you have to have at least a 50% success rate to be considered a viable alternative.
Well, I think at this point we would take whatever we can get if there's a way to get immunity to COVID without putting yourself and your family at risk of dying, then I think the efficacy of the vaccine is probably negotiable. I don't know that there's any magic number. You know, the influenza vaccine annually probably only works about 50-60% of the time. I know that getting the vaccine decreases, how sick people tend to get with flu. So if the vaccine's 100%, then 100% effective in preventing COVID, then 70% of people need to get that vaccine to get herd immunity, but it's probably not going to be. It'll some number less than 100%.
We are also hearing reports that the virus may not be as deadly as first thought. Is there science to back that up, or is this just another distraction from what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question. So many things with COVID, we learn more as time goes on. You might remember the Diamond outbreak. That was that cruise ship that was docked off of Yokohama, Japan back in, I think, March. And the fatality rate of people that got COVID on that boat was about 1%. And that's a situation where we know exactly how many people got it. We know, the numerator and denominator in that fraction, and it was about 1%. So we've learned more and come to understand that more people have this virus without showing symptoms. It's been recognized that there are a lot of infected people that dilute out that number so that the true number of the mortality rate per case is probably on the order of 0.5%. That's so one out of every 200 people that gets this will die from COVID, which is, better than we used to think it was, but it's still acceptably high.
How does that compare with the flu with a vaccine?
What the mortality rate from flu, it's probably 10% of that. It may be like 0.1% or less. And with a vaccine, the risk of dying is some smaller number. I give you a number on that.
Do we know when this first started? I don't remember who it was. It might have been the president, might have been somebody else, said that, oh, well, when the weather gets warmer, this will die off. And obviously we haven't seen that. Do we have any indication that any kind of weather change would even make a difference at this point?
One of the highest rates of infection in the world is in India right now. And it's not cold there. Has high infection rates. It's their winter right now, but I think their winter is probably warmer than ours. I don't see a great reason for optimism that in the seasons makes that much of a difference. You know, we're in the summer right now, and our number of cases is rising. Total number of deaths is rising in this country. Unfortunately, it looks like that's not really going to matter very much. What matters is the fact that nobody has ever had this infection before.
Now, what about as we turn into the fall months and the onset of flu comes? Is this going to be a difficult situation for doctors to, on the onset, you do a test and you'd find out whether it's the flu or whether it's COVID-19. But there's going to probably be a lot of fear of people that may get the flu and think, I've got COVID-19. Is there concern?
Yeah, I mean, the symptoms can be pretty much indistinguishable. And when flu starts to circulate, that's really going to be a problem. Patients often get sick and they need to be in the hospital. They need to be in the intensive care unit, which means that they're occupying hospital beds that we might need for people with COVID. Or they might come to the hospital and be concerned that they might get infected by being hospitalized. And, you know, all of those are reasons why this year, more than perhaps any year in my lifetime, it's important to get a vaccine against influenza. They're not a vaccine, as I said, but they're what we have, and they can help our hospitals and our populations protect people from getting flu.
Now, as we come into the season again, now I know on certain years sometimes the flu vaccine that they come out with is like, you know, spot on, and the percentage goes up a little bit. Some years it might be down a little bit and more people might not be affected. But do we have any kind of prediction of how bad the flu season might be this year? Are there any indicators? Do we go from one year to another to kind of determine how bad the season is going to be?
I think it's just too early at this point to say. And in terms of how well the vaccine matches the circulating flu strain, we usually don't know that until later in the season, say January or something like that. So anybody's guess, unfortunately.
How about a prediction? Is there any kind of indication? I know they said maybe, you know, by the end of the year a while back. I understand it's moving along pretty well. Could it be that first responders maybe get to have the vaccine for COVID-19, maybe as late as October, end of October?
I don't know how rapidly that's moving along the timeline. I'm sure that there are populations of people like responders that are going to be prioritized for getting the vaccine. Elderly folks, probably, you know, people in skilled nursing facilities and other underlying medical problems have put some dying from COVID probably will be high priority. October, pretty early, you know, earlier than I would expect, we can get an approved COVID vaccine. There's a vaccine in China that the Chinese government has already approved for use by their military. I don't really know if that's effective or not, or we don't have much data on that.
Do we know, is there a difference in our reporting from someone who died from COVID versus died with COVID? Do they take those numbers out when they're figuring that, or is it kind of all one lump sum?
When you know, about death certificates before, and they ask the physician to come up with his or her best impression of what led to the person's death, and I think that's what these are based on, is what disease led to their death. Like if somebody's got emphysema and heart failure, and then they get COVID, did they die of the COVID, or did they die of their emphysema or heart failure? And sometimes it's a judgment call.
So there might be some slight differences in the numbers there, but not enough to make a case for.
You know, I think it's as reliable as any action of cause of death for anything. I mean, I don't see any reason to think that there would be any systemic bias in how physicians fill those things out in every state and every county and every country in the world. I mean, I think that those data are as accurate as they are for any other disease.
Our last question here, being part of the governor's task force, when you guys meet together, what are some of the top buttons that you guys are hitting right now?
Yeah, well, just about every meeting starts with a county by county breakdown of how Oregon is doing with COVID. You're probably aware that Umatilla County has an outbreak right now, and Oregon State University just did a study out there that estimated that maybe as high as 17% of the people in Umatilla County, or excuse me, in Hermiston, might have COVID, which tells us that living in a small community like Florence doesn't mean that you're protected from this disease necessarily. I mean, Hermiston is not a big city, and they've got a really high rate of COVID. And the result has been that the governor has had to back off on opening up the economy in Umatilla County because COVID is out of control. So I think it just emphasizes how important it is that this disease is everywhere and that nobody really can count on being safe with it. Then you asked about the governor's panel. We talk about something different every week. We talked about contact tracing in yesterday's meeting, sort of how effective are we at contact tracing. Big part of the problem there is that it can take a week sometimes for these tests to come back. So if you want to tell somebody that they need to isolate and it takes a week to get a test back, then half of the time that they're contagious has already passed. But you get in touch with them, and it kind of makes it pointless to do the contact tracing at that point. So some of those problems with the delay in getting test results that we were seeing back in February and March, unfortunately, are starting to show up again, which really hampers our ability to try to control the outbreak.
And my understanding is with community spread, it's kind of hard to do contact tracing. Is that right?
You bet it is. Yeah, I mean, that's the definition of community spread is you talk to somebody who's got COVID, and if they know that they came in contact with anybody that COVID, then you really can never find out where it came from. And again, in Hermiston, that seems to be the predominant way that this virus is getting transmitted, is people getting it from people that they don't know to be infected.
Dr. Bob Pelz, thank you so much for spending time with us today. It's good to have this information out there and share with the folks of Florence here. And I know that we sure do appreciate the work you're doing with the Governor's Task Force and with Peace Health. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
What's happening with high school athletics? Well, we'll find out from Chris Johnson right after this on this edition of Our Town.